You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hi, Shadi.
Hi, Bob.
How you doing?
Doing good. Good to be back on Blogging Heads.
Good to have you here. Let me introduce us. I am Robert Wright. This is The Wright Show, available in both streaming video and via audio podcast subscription. You are Shadi Hamid. You are a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. You write for a lot of places, I guess most consistently for The Atlantic these days, right?
That's right, yeah.
You're the author of Temptations of Power, Islamists and a Liberal Democracy in a New Middle East. But more relevant to our conversation today, you're the author of this, which is just being published as we speak, Islamic Exceptionalism, How the Struggle Over Islam is Reshaping the World. And that's what we're going to talk about today. So for starters, maybe you could talk about the title a little. I suspect that most people have heard the word exceptionalism in the context of American exceptionalism lately, which I take to mean that, to be the idea that America is special, maybe in some sense better than other countries, but in any event, uniquely entitled or qualified to do certain things. How does your use of the term exceptionalism compare with that? What exactly do you mean by Islamic exceptionalism?
Yeah, well, so first of all, I wanted to sort of put the main argument right there in the title. Mm-hmm. So essentially, and we'll talk about this more, but one of the main arguments I'm making is that Islam is in fact exceptional in how it relates to politics. Mm-hmm. And I thought exceptionalism was actually a good word to use because in my view, at least, it's value neutral. Exceptionalism can either be good or bad, depending on the context. And it'll be interesting for me, at least, to see how Americans versus others respond to the title, because it does sort of draw on this idea of American exceptionalism, which we generally see as a positive thing, I would say. But I think there's also a sense that being exceptional can also be a problem, that if everyone is one way and you're a different way, that can also produce its own set of problems. So I think in that sense, the title captures the complexity of what we're talking about, that there aren't easy answers. It's neither obviously good nor bad. And we have to look at how Islam translates into everyday life in particular contexts and then determine, is this example good or bad, and so on.
Okay. So you want to emphasize for American and other readers that they shouldn't assume that Islam is more or less like the religion they're familiar with, Christianity, whatever, in particular in how it relates to politics, right?
Exactly. So I think this part will be controversial for some people. And I think that there's a liberal faith in the U.S., at least on the coasts, that we all ultimately want the same things. All the great religions essentially have this, basically the same founding principles, and there's a kind of universality that applies to all peoples, all cultures, and all societies. And that's well-intentioned, and I understand the desire to emphasize that now, especially in a time of Islamophobia, but I don't think it's analytically accurate. I don't think it's true. And that's what I want this book to do, is to sort of force at least more people to reckon with that possibility that Islam may in fact be different in very important ways that have implications for how we see the Middle East.
Okay.
So I personally, when I look at it, I don't see Islam's distinctiveness as necessarily being a bad thing. Where I think you would find people who would say, well, it is a bad thing. So, I mean, that will be, I think, part of a debate here.
Right. And I guess you would say that not understanding its distinctiveness could be a bad thing. It could lead us to do things that are counterproductive, in your view.
Yeah, because if we insist on fitting Islam into this essentially Christian framework, that Islam has to follow the same trajectory as Christianity did many centuries ago, so going through a Reformation, Counter-Reformation, Enlightenment, onto modernity, this kind of natural trajectory towards the end of history, let's say, that the arc of history is bending in a particular direction, I think to sort of superimpose that construct on a religion that is very different in critical ways is problematic. I think it's also patronizing and presumptuous. I mean, why exactly should Muslims have to follow the same path that Christians did before? I mean, that to me, that presumption is so implicit in a lot of the conversations we have in the era of ISIS. And it goes without saying, and that's what troubles me, that it just seems so obvious to people. And I want to challenge that.
I mean, there are a lot of people it doesn't seem obvious to. There are a lot of people who think that the opposite almost is obvious, that these people are radically different. And I assume you think it's possible to err in that direction as well. I mean, to overestimate the kind of rigidity of current beliefs and if that makes sense.
Yeah, so there's no doubt that there are people, and I would sort of put them on, let's say, the Islamophobic right, people mm-hmm. who seem to have a kind of anti-Muslim bigotry. In those kinds of circles, it's very common to say, well, Islam is different, it's bad, it's prone to violence and all of those things. I'm not sure how much progress can be made with people who already have those deeply held opinions about an entire religion and aren't willing to look at the nuance. But I think there are a lot of people in between, and certainly a lot of politically correct, let's say, American and European liberals who want to believe or convince themselves that Islam will end up the same way Christianity did, and it's just a matter of time. So they might say, yes, Islam is different now. Yes, it plays an outsized role in politics today, but that's only because it hasn't yet gone through this process of reformation. Mm-hmm. And I also want to essentially say, well, Islam may not actually end up going through that kind of reformation. And then we have to sort of contend with this possibility that 50 years or 100 years down the road, Islam still hasn't gone through a Christian-style reformation. So also the idea here is to challenge this liberal determinism that, again, we all end up going in the same direction because history has a natural progression to it, which is really, I think, part – it's so – intrinsic to the liberal faith, if you will, I think, at least among many of the liberals that I tend to hang out with, let's say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and to some extent, I think that includes me, but we can get to that later, if at all. So I want to get to the question of this whole Reformation business, and also some of the specific kind of applications of your ideas to contemporary and recent events, because you do make those applications in the book. So, for example, to ISIS, to the Arab Spring, and the to me particularly interesting case of Egypt. So I want to get to all those, but let's start even earlier than the Reformation. Why don't you talk about what parts of early Islamic history, in your view, make it different from other religions in ways that people may not appreciate?
Well, sure. So, we really have to go back, I suppose, to the 7th century for this. And so I do believe that founding moments matter. And Muslims aren't bound to their founding moment, but they can't fully escape it either. And this is where I think we really have to understand the person of Prophet Muhammad and what he represented, that this was someone who was not just a cleric or a theologian or a prophet, he was also a head of state. He was a politician. Mm-hmm. And this wasn't by accident. That was actually by design. And the religious and political functions of his rule were intertwined. And so when people say, well, why does the Quran as scripture have more to say about law and politics than the New Testament has, that's also a product of circumstance. The Quran had to say something about law and governance because Prophet Muhammad was in a position where he had to govern a political community, where if you look at the New Testament, it's not going to say much about governance because Jesus was never in a position to rule. he was a dissident against a reigning state. So you can certainly argue that Christianity from its founding moment has a kind of oppositional posture. And Reza Aslan, I think, makes that case very well in his book on this. But that's to say that there's a kind of oppositional politics is not the same as saying that there's a message about governing or about ruling a state, right? So I think that's one thing. And actually, I mean, even in the early centuries of Christianity, Christians were a minority being ruled under other groups or societies or religions and so on. So it wasn't until several centuries later that Christians had to contend with questions of governance. So that's one thing. The second thing is, and this took me some time to fully grasp, I'm not going to claim to be an expert in Christianity, but for this book, I did try to read up as much as I could on Christian theology. And, you know, we talk about biblical inerrancy, right? But Quranic inerrancy, I found, is just at it's at a different level. And that may seem obvious to some people and less obvious to others. I'm not sure. But even today, far-right Christian evangelicals, they'll say that the Bible is the word of God. But that doesn't mean they think the Bible is God's actual speech. Mm-hmm. And I think that distinction is very important. Where Muslims would say, as a creedal requirement to be a Muslim, you technically have to believe that not only is the Quran the word of God, it's God's actual speech. In other words, there's no human authorship, there's no human involvement, none of that. Every single letter in the Quran is directly from God himself.
Right. And, of course, you could say, well, there are seeming contradictions, certainly of emphasis, within the Quran. And it's just a kind of interesting footnote, by the way, is that, you know, as you know, I mean, all the verses in the Quran are thought to have been proclaimed either in Mecca or Medina. Muhammad starts his career in Mecca, then goes to Medina. And interestingly, in Mecca, his position is a little like Jesus's. He's you know, he's a rebel. He's not part of the establishment, right. and he's not being treated well. And but then you're right. He goes to Medina and becomes, in effect, mayor of Medina. And as I said, so then the rest of the Quran is thought to be proclaimed there. Although, of course, it's not sequential in the Quran. It's not in chronological order. But in any event, you know, so you might say, well, but you know, you can pick and choose your verses from in the Quran. It's a matter of interpretation. But there, I think you might emphasize another kind of distinction with Christianity, which is because as the holy text coalesced, it was a governing religion. You know, in the aftermath, there developed a system of legal interpretation that, you know, and the Hadith, you know, the sayings of the Prophet were part of this, you know, part of the grounds for, in turn, interpreting the Quran. But there developed systems of legal interpretation that tried to settle some of these seeming contradictions. And so it's true that the text almost, you know, it's part of an immediate evolution into a system of law, right? In a way that Christianity is not.
Well, exactly. And I should probably emphasize something. So Muslims may believe that the Quran is the literal word of God, but that does not mean that Muslims are literalist. There's a small minority of Muslims that we would categorize as literalist. But you can still take the Quran to be the exact God's exact actual speech. But then there's still a lot of room for diversity and interpretation, because just because God said something doesn't mean you know why he said it. So you have to look at intent, the context of revelation. So obviously the verses about violence are very controversial and people always debate those, right? But, you know, it makes a big difference how you situate those verses. Were those verses revealed in the context of a particular battle at a particular time? And if so, they may not be applicable for all times or contexts. So there still is a great deal of room for diverse legal interpretation. But you're certainly right that there was an elaborate legal structure that evolved early on in the development of Islam. And there are four main schools of Islamic law, at least in the Sunni tradition. And there you do have, again, quite a bit of diversity. But what all those schools share is a basic sense that Islam is very much involved in everyday life, politics, and governance, and that it cannot be privatized, it cannot be separated. Mm-hmm. So no one really, until the modern era, disagreed with that, you know? And that's why, if we had talked 3 centuries ago, the word Islamism wouldn't make any sense, because Islamism only makes sense in opposition to something else, secularism. Mm-hmm. But in the pre-modern era, Islam's role in everyday life went without saying, so it was never said. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think where modernity becomes such a destabilizing force for Muslim majority populations is that it questions this basic order of things, this overarching religious culture that had been there for the better part of 12 centuries.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, let's see. So there is a body of legal interpretation. And as you said, diverse legal interpretation. There is variation. There are different schools one can draw on. And also, there have been innovations over time. There has been evolution of the legal interpretation. And there are different strands you can choose. So ISIS, for example, I gather, puts a lot of emphasis on some guy who lived around the 13th or 14th century, who even then was a little marginal. I mean, it wasn't the mainstream interpretation even then, but he in turn asserted that the only valid version of Islam is the kind that was practiced and enunciated by these, I guess, the prophet and a few, you know, contemporaries, more or less. And so that's just an example of that, you know, and then you get these letters from other imams saying, no, ISIS is wrong. But there is a guy that ISIS can point to from 7 centuries ago who in turn, you know, who had the, so that's just to give people some sense that there is variation. It's not a monolithic legal interpretation, I guess you would say.
Exactly, yeah. And it's a very diverse one. And that's why I think you see so many different strands of Islamic practice. And even if we just focus on Islamist movements, on the extreme far right, we have ISIS. And then if we go quite a bit of the way to the left, we have parties like Ennahda, which kind of are self-styled progressive Islamists. So, I mean, that's why I think it's very problematic for us to talk about Islamism writ large as one general thing or one general problem, when the range of groups that we have in the region today are quite numerous. And in some contexts, they actually oppose each other, or even consider each other apostates. ISIS considers the Muslim Brotherhood to be apostate, so on and so forth. So when I talk about Islam playing an exceptional role, I would never want people to take from that I'm saying Islam is just one thing. Mm-hmm. What I am arguing, though, is that Islam as a faith tradition has been and will continue to be resistant to secularization. That is one of the main arguments I'm trying to put forth.
Okay. So let's, I want to talk about this Reformation business. Before we do that, since you've used the term Islamism a few times, why don't you go ahead and define it? Because I actually think there's some confusion over that.
Yeah.
There are even people who think it means the same as Islam. So why don't you tell us what you mean by Islamism?
So I generally define Islamist groups or parties as Islamist groups are those that believe that Islam and Islamic law should play a central role in public life and politics. That would be the general definition I would use. And that's also generally how most academics approach the term. Now, then we get into questions of what does it mean to believe Islamic law should play a central role? And that's where there's room for diversity. But that would be the general definition.
Mm-hmm. And I think one thing you're saying is that people should not expect that attitude to disappear anytime soon. I mean, the support for a kind of, you know, close relationship between church and state, you might say.
Well, so you can have Islamists who believe in a certain who believe in a degree of separation between mosque and state, but that's not the same as believing in a separation between religion and politics. And the latter is what I would really focus on. Because actually, if you look at pre-modern Islamic history, it was the clerical class that was somewhat self-regulating and autonomous. And they would actually provide a meaningful check on power on the sultan or the caliph. So you can. So those are two different things. But what I would say is this idea that there can be a real separation between Islam and politics, we should not expect that to happen anytime soon, certainly not in our lifetimes. And I would also, the second question would be, why would we even assume that in the first place? So the fact that that's a built-in assumption in so many of our conversations is part of what's so troubling to me. Why would that be the case? And then why should it be the case? Why? And look, I'm personally liberal. I personally am skeptical of the role of religion in politics. And that's particularly the case now in the U.S. with someone like Donald Trump maybe rising to power. So I really get that. And I think that for me, and based on my own experiences as an American, I think that having a state that is religiously and ideologically neutral is important. But then why should my personal inclinations or beliefs be imposed on other people who don't share my starting assumptions? And that's a question I always pose to people when I get in this debate. Well, they say, well, we think this is better. Liberalism is better. Secularism is better. And then that, yes, it may be from our standpoint, but you can't force people to be liberal or secular against their will if they don't want to be, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, that's my view. I am definitely with you there that we should be in many ways wary of assuming that everyone is going to share our values as soon as we explain to them how enlightened we are. I guess one answer you might get to the question as you posed it, like why should we expect that, is some people would say, well, because in the case of Christianity, there were times in the past when there was a much more symbiotic relationship between church and state, when people, when the average Christian, you might say, took their religion more seriously, when more Christians said, I'm happy to die in this holy war and go to heaven. There have been times when these various elements that you may see surfacing now in parts of Islam were prominent in Christianity. So people say, well, I mean, this is the logic, right? They say, well, you know, stuff happened. Maybe it was the influence of science, whatever. And now you see there was, in fact, some degree of secularization. Although, of course, even now in the United States, you see a kind of a backlash against secular values, and you see some Christians becoming, in a way, more fundamentalist than they might have been 50 years ago. But leaving that aside, I think that's a generic answer. So maybe that leads us to this Reformation question. I mean, I've personally never bought that argument because it's not obvious to me that the Reformation is, in fact, what ushered in modern Western secularism, right? I mean, but maybe that's because I don't know enough about history. So why don't you talk a little about what you think happened with the Christian Reformation, sure. and why you think we should not expect the analog with Islam?
Okay, so you're right that there was definitely, there were many centuries in the medieval era and beyond, actually, where Christianity did play a very important role in people's everyday lives and so on. But there was, from the very beginning in the development of Christian theology, there was a kind of dualism. So even if you look at St. Augustine's work, The City of Man and the City of God, and the very idea that you would have monasteries was a reflection of that, that the world was fallen with sin, and that there was no way to strive. You had to sort of remove yourself from worldly affairs to be truly pure. So that idea is very much there in various strains of Christian theology. But also I think that there was never a real equivalent in Christianity to Sharia law. You had canon law, but canon law isn't quite the same thing. That's more about the internal organization of the Catholic Church and its surroundings. But we're not talking about a very developed account of public law. So I think that's a big difference, and one that has major implications to this day. Because when we talk about Christian evangelicals in the U.S., they're talking about Christian values influencing policy and politics. They are generally not talking about Christian law. But even the fact that I would use this phrase Christian law, that's a bit weird, because that's not really even a phrase people use.
Right.
Because there isn't Christian law the way there is Islamic law. But anyway,
I would say quickly that I think a lot of them believe that American governance or governing values should be Christian values, which, you know, is analogous to a kind of attitude that is kind of at the core of Islamism in a very generic and vague sense. And on specific issues, some of them certainly believe it's fair to argue that, wait a second, this is in the Bible. That's why the policy should be this. But I take your point that there's a big difference, because, you know, for one thing, I mean, for centuries and centuries and centuries, Islam was a governing religion. And an explicit, it wasn't just like a kind of a loosely symbiotic relationship between church and state. It was a governing religion. And there's no doubt that that has made a difference. That fell apart in the early 20th century when the final caliphate kind of dissolved the Ottoman Empire, but there's no doubt that there are real differences. But
I would, on the issue of the Reformation, I would, so what I argue in the book is that actually Christianity did fight a good fight. It's not as if these ideas of secularism were being introduced and Christianity just failed to offer resistance. Actually, I mean, Christianity tried, but ultimately, I would argue, succumbed. And that to me is a very interesting question. Why couldn't Christianity, and particularly the Catholic Church, offer greater resistance? And I think part of that is Christianity was unable to assimilate or absorb modern ideas that were being introduced in the 18th and 19th century. So we see the rise of socialism, of mass politics, of parliamentary process, of lay burial even. I mean, so we have these ideas, universal suffrage, and the church actually resisted those ideas. It wasn't able to absorb them into the broader Christian tradition. So Christianity, at least in certain countries, found itself on the opposing side of these newly popular ideas. Mm-hmm. Where Islam, and this might actually be somewhat counterintuitive, and this is why I actually think Islam is a very modern religion, or it actually works well with modernity in certain ways, is that it's able to take modern ideas and assimilate them and give them a kind of Islamic cast or Islamize them. So we can talk about Islamic democracy, we can talk about Islamic socialism, Islamic banking, Islamic finance, Islamic Calvinism, Islamic whatever you want. So Islam has, and its legal tradition, has a kind of inherent flexibility to it, where it's able to take things that seem outside of the faith and bring them in. Where I would argue Christianity, for a variety of reasons, wasn't able to do that at a very critical moment in the 18th and 19th centuries. That's one thing. So, and the other thing I would just mention is that the Reformation in Christianity was a response to clerical despotism. Clerical despotism has not generally been the main problem in the Muslim majority world. If anything, I would argue it's the bigger problem has been secular despotism. And as I mentioned earlier, it was in fact the clerical class that provided a check on executive power. So if anything, they contributed to a kind of early version of separation of powers.
And what's an historical example of that happening?
Well, so for the clerics to grant legitimacy to a caliph or to the caliphate more generally, they essentially there was an almost a kind of understanding that the caliph had broad discretionary power, but ultimately he was accountable to something beyond himself, the legal tradition, Sharia. And who were the keepers of Sharia? The clerics. And there was also a considerable decentralization. So we're not talking about modern states where the sultan or the caliph controls everything. A lot of legal practice was happening at the local level, and that's not something the caliph could really interfere with.
Right.
So we're also, I think, it's hard to talk about Islamic law in the modern context, in part because Islamic law wasn't designed for modern nation states. It was designed for the pre-modern era. And I think that's also part of what makes it so difficult to find a reconciliation now. But I would say that was the basic bargain that we saw through centuries of Islamic history, this kind of self-regulating clerical class that could say to the caliph, well, actually, this is our own domain. We're going to issue our own legal judgments on the local level. And if you interfere too much, then we can always question your legitimacy.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I gather that, I mean, there was decentralization within the clergy in a certain sense, right? I mean, it's not like, it probably differed from time to time, place to place, but certainly right now, it's not like there's a pope. I mean, there's lots of imams that have varying degrees of stature. And, you know, I think that even in Iran, that you know, more than one opinion matters, right?
Exactly. And this is actually, I think, an example of something that can either be very positive or kind of negative. When we think, well, oh, there's diversity of scholars and there's decentralization. And really, you have such a situation now where people who don't have the best qualifications can sort of self-advertise as preachers or imams or whatever. And that can actually be dangerous because you can have a lot of Salafi, ultra-conservative preachers who claim legitimacy, and they're saying, well, we don't care about the established tradition. We're going to make our own judgments.
Right.
And that's where you have people like the clerics of the Islamic State or Al-Qaeda, who are not regarded as part of the mainstream tradition, but because of the decentralization we've seen over decades, they can build their own kind of local base of support and get their ideas out to a larger audience.
And that actually is a little analogous to Protestantism. I mean, because there's no centralized authority, you get this churning and this creation of whole new denominations and it's kind of radical evolution of denominations and so on. Okay, so you want to... One thing you want to guard against, while emphasizing that there can be such thing as Islamic democracy, even according to some Islamists, you want to guard against what you consider a kind of naive assumption that it would look a whole lot like what we think of or what our ideal, the Western ideal of democracy is, right? And I think you got into this in your last book.
Yeah, exactly. That liberalism and democracy are not the same. Sometimes they can be in tension. Democracy is more about representatives and leaders being responsive and accountable to the voting public, and a relationship with citizens in a kind of vertical relationship. And there has to be meaningful competition in a democracy. There has to be some degree of civil liberty so people can express their views. But that's what I would emphasize when we're talking about democracy, where liberalism is more about the non-negotiable personal rights and freedoms and civil liberties that aren't necessarily intrinsically part of the democratic idea. And that's why we see this tension in many different contexts. And it's not just in the Middle East with the role of religion in public life. And this is why I think the rise of Trump, as scary as it is for me personally, I think it helps Americans understand this tension in a more acute way. That Trump, you know, we actually stand the chance of electing our first ever illiberal Democrat. That would be very interesting if it happened, and I think it would challenge a lot of our assumptions there. Mm-hmm. So we should
emphasize, in case anyone doesn't get it, that when you say a liberal Democrat, you don't mean Democrat with a big D, and you're not talking about liberalism in the sense of on the American political spectrum. You mean classical
liberalism.
Right, right. Okay, so with that, go ahead.
Yeah. And when it comes to things like Islamic democracy or whatever you want to call that, it raises this question, which I think is very difficult for us as Americans to answer, which is, what if, Egyptians, Jordanians, Tunisians, whatever, decide through the democratic process that they don't want to be liberal? What if they decide to pass through a parliament, through a legislative process, constitutional amendments which restrict personal freedom? Mm-hmm. So that would be democratic in the sense that it would be responsive to the popular will, mm-hmm. but it would be contrary to classical liberalism in that it would restrict personal freedoms. But I mean, this is something we deal with here even in the US. I mean, prohibition is an example of this. You can override constitutional protections. You can introduce new amendments if you have, let me make sure I have this right, 2/3 of both houses of Congress and 75% of the states. So theoretically, if there were enough extremist people in the U.S. and they lobbied their representatives, they could essentially negate parts of the Bill of Rights if they really wanted to. So it's not as if constitutions are 100% protection against the tyranny of majority. It's only a question of how high the majoritarian bar is.
This concludes part one of the interview with Shadi Hamid, author of Islamic Exceptionalism, How the Struggle Over Islam is Reshaping the World.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.